It's reboot wheat. Wheat? Wheat. Reboot wheat. Get moving away from corn. Going into wheat yes. now.
And welcome to episode 5 of The Film File, the film show for film geeks by film geeks. I'm Lee Ford.
I'm Andy Meakin.
And hello. And we've got a lot to get through as usual on this show. Of course, we're talking about the big film that everyone's talking about, including on the BBC last night. I heard one of the, you know, those very serious critique shows talking about this film. Dora the Explorer.
Yeah, I mean, what a film. I mean, you know, we've been waiting for a Dora film to come to the big screen for ages.
And here it is. No. We joke. We'll be talking about Joker. But first, Andy has been scouring the world of the internet, the World Wide Web, bringing you some of the latest news, gossip and information just for you. Andy, what you got for us?
Well, we've got some nostalgia in this week. Inspector Gadget.
Really?
The 1980s cartoon. That was made into a film with...
Matthew Broderick. Forgettable, though it was. Rupert Everett was the villain.
Yeah.
Why do I know these things?
It was mindless, like, throwaway entertainment. Good for families, but never really tapped into the core of, like, the heart
who
of
Gadget
the,
really is.
Yeah. There's now a new version of the film.
Of course there is.
Being brought to the big screen. Dan, Lynn and Jonathan Eyrick, who produced the recent Aladdin film, they've jumped on board to bring a live-action take on Inspector Gadget for Disney.
We kind of touched on this the other week, didn't we, about films that have been rebooted that are a generational thing, or characters that have been rebooted that are generational. And Inspector Gadget, as you said...
It's the 80s.
It's the 80s and the 90s. I'm slightly older. You wouldn't believe it. But I'm slightly older, so it means nothing to me. And it's a bit like if they were to bring back, I don't know, the Clangers movie. I think it's older guys in an office are going, do you remember how good Inspector Gadget was? Who owns that IP now? Let's have it. And completely forgetting, my kid would never have a clue about Inspector Gadget. Troll Hunters, he's going to be rebooting that in 20 years. Have you seen that, by the way? Guillermo del Toro's series on Netflix. Great. I'll let him watch it so I can watch it. That's the trick of good parenting, introducing movies. But I think there's an issue with bringing on these characters who we think are still sellable or are still prolific in today when, to be perfectly honest, the generations have moved on. But if it's a good film and it's done well, who would you cast as Inspector Gadget?
Well, I'd cast Ryan Reynolds as anything these days.
Yeah, you've got a man crush though.
I've got a huge man crush on that.
You know, I was actually going to say Ryan Reynolds. There you go.
He's got that kind of charisma and wit.
Yeah.
Or just bring Matthew Broderick back.
Yes, he could be the villain this time. There you go. Ryan Reynolds, if you're listening, we put you forward for Inspector Gadget. And you could sort of do it Deadpool-y as well. Have lots of jokes.
Joke to the camera.
About the appendages that he can fit onto his arm. Well, that sort of thing.
Whether they're going to stick it as keep going for the family-friendly route or not is a bit unsure at the moment. But Saturday Night Live writers Mikey Day and Streeter Seidel are penning the script, which suggests that they're going to be trying to do a lot of in-jokes for the adult crowd in that Saturday Night Live.
It's going to have to be, because you can just, you know...
They've got to grab the attention of us people. If it's made to look as though it's just going to be too kiddified, then the people who they're clearly wanting to aim at, i.e. the people who know who Inspector Gadget are, will be alienated. So they need to try and get that balance between them so that maybe our generation can introduce a new generation to this character and hopefully get the new generation to understand what we loved about that character in the same way.
Talking of which, you heard that Kevin Smith's bringing about He-Man for Netflix.
Yeah, I heard about that.
He's producing an animated version. I don't think it's going to be sort of set in a store and He-Man's like behind the counter now. But I think, you know, from what I hear, it's going to be very reverent to the character of He-Man. And again, it's those producers bringing back stuff that they liked as kids.
There was a pretty solid like revisit of He-Man as an animated series in the early part of this century.
Oh, was it?
It had the look and the feel of the old one, but with a more structured story and none of that like cutting at the end to like, the lesson we've learned today, Orko, is...
See, that's what I hated about it.
Yeah, it took away that and just had it as like a continuous story set over episodes in the way that animations are these days. I mean, it's similar to like the Thundercats one from about 10 years ago, which
Missed
was
that.
Very short-lived. The animation style was beautiful, but it was different to the original.
Right.
So people were alienated by it and didn't jump on. I jumped on it. I'm so glad I did, because it retold the origins of the Thundercats in a continuous story.
Right.
It wasn't just like single episode, single episode, single episode. It was like an ongoing journey. It's really solidly made, solidly produced.
Interesting.
Never found its audience.
I've got a bit of news for us. The full cast for Kenneth Branagh's Poirot sequel, Death on the Nile, has been announced.
Oh, I'm imagining, given the history of the character, that we're going to see some stellar names in there.
Well, I know it's carrying on with this theme. I mean, Murder on the Orient Express, all versions have had big names attached to it, and he's filmed it. I really liked Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, I mean, the only drawback that film had is that we already knew the story.
Yeah.
And so there was no real surprises.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That doesn't diminish the fact that it was a beautifully made film with a cast who were really getting into their roles and clearly enjoying their roles.
Cast to die for. I liked his approach to Poirot.
I liked his moustache.
The moustache was fabulous. I would spend all my life growing that moustache.
I'd spend all my life trying to find a moustache like that.
But he's got a great cast. He's pulled together. Everybody wants to work with... he's just one of those guys people want to work with. And he's movie star royalty for this country.
Yeah.
I mean, he's done some duds. But yeah, great cast. Annette Bening, Russell Brand, Dawn French, Gil Gadot, Armie Hammer. He needs a hit. Desperately, Armie Hammer. He's still everybody's choice for Batman, but I don't see it myself. Rosie Leslie, Jennifer Saunders, Letitia Wright. So a lot of people we know from superhero genres. But if I remember the original, the Albert Finney version, you know, again, great cast. Looking forward to it. Yeah. If he does as well as he does on Murder, then of course he will. There's no doubt about it.
Spend the budget wisely.
Yeah.
Use it in the right way and just tell a well-told story. Because let's be honest, those stories, the Poirot stories, are really good stories. They're really good mysteries and whodunits. And there's a reason why they keep getting remade and remade. No one ever complains about a remake of a Poirot story or like any of Agatha Christie's materials, because you just accept that it's worth bringing that back to the screen again.
They stay very true. You have to stay true. And I think you can set them, you can jump time, that they work. It's like Holmes. Sherlock Holmes, for me, works best in Victorian England.
Yeah.
And this is to take nothing away than the BBC version, which I absolutely adored. I thought it was a fantastic series. I thought if you're going to do Holmes in present day, that's the way to do it. But for me, I like Conan Doyle's references. I like the period. I like period detective mysteries. But if you're going to do it well, the stories work. It's like why Shakespeare can still work.
Yeah.
Because the stories are truly told, beautifully scripted, beautifully anointed stories. It doesn't matter when you set them. And Poirot's an interesting character. And he gave Poirot something that I'd never seen before. He gave him a dimension I'd never seen before, and can't wait.
So moving on to No Time to Die.
The new Bond film.
The new Bond film. We finally had a poster.
You're great. They started filming, I've noticed.
My problem with the poster, and it's been a problem with the posters through all of these like Daniel Craig ones, is they kind of lack the dynamic of the classic Bond posters. The classic Bond posters was always like a composite image of like, you know, Bond with a gun and a girl next to him, like either with a gun, etc. The backdrop of like San Francisco or a Tahiti beach or like wherever the location's going to be, and like some explosions, some bits of action. And I love that old like 70s, 80s, well, 60s, 70s and 80s style of poster making. And I feel that they've gone a bit too like...
clean and Photoshop-y.
To be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because the Bourne posters were very much a case of, oh, look, there's Matt Damon.
Very brutal.
Oh, look, there's Matt Damon with a target on him. Yeah. Oh, look, there's Matt Damon with a target behind him. Oh, look what we've done there. And they kind of tried to copy that style with the Bond ones.
Do you think that's the same across movie posters in general now?
You do see a lot of themes on movie posters that as soon as something snaps someone's attention, every movie suddenly copies that style. I mean, look at your romantic comedies of the Love Actually kind of stable.
Yeah.
But they all have that exact same white background with a red stripe on it and then just images of the cast across them.
Or two characters leaning. Matthew McConaughey went through a lot of leaning, didn't he?
He was always leaning back to back with someone.
Yeah, lots of leaning, the Pretty Woman style. I think the art of, and I think great movie posters are still being made. And when they do come along and they stand out and you realise them, is when they're not just Photoshopped monstrosities. And I love the Marvel films. God praise getting Kevin Feige, you know, but for a comic book company, ultimately, and Disney,
their posters are very
slapdash. You know, are Photoshop monstrosities a lot of the time.
The Spider-Man ones in particular. Obviously, they must have used the Disney marketing team and not the Sony marketing team, because Sony tend to do better marketing when it comes to posters, a bit more creative, whereas Disney seems to be just going, like you say, going for the just composite images.
And talking of Bond, my reference point for Bond, it wasn't the first Bond I ever saw. The first one I ever saw in the cinema was Diamonds Are Forever. But I went to see Live and Let Die, and I will never forget the poster. It was just a visceral amount of colour. You know, it had Bond in the middle, it had the playing cards, it had Jane Seymour looking super hot. All those characters built around Bond, beautifully painted. And that's a poster for me. That's a cinema poster. It has to, to some extent, had to be bigger than the film to attract it. And, you know, I kind of miss those big posters. I've seen it. I'm looking forward to it. I've really enjoyed the Daniel Craig run on it. And we talked about it a few weeks, who would replace him. I still think he should have ended at the last movie, because Driving Away was the perfect ending. And
well, it's where they're going to pick up with the story, because he's now living in retirement in Jamaica. And apparently it's Felix who shows up and asks him to help rescue a kidnapped scientist, putting Bond on the trail of a new mysterious villain with dangerous new technology.
And that's why there's a new 007. And it's a black actor playing a lady 007. It's not replacing Bond. It's replacing 007. Get it right, kids.
Just taking the 00 from it.
Yeah, and if he's retired, of course, they're not just going to leave it until he hopefully walks back in. He's retired. That's why there's an 007 spot waiting to be filled. Get over it, kids.
Nice to see, you know, Ralph Fiennes is back as M.
Yeah, I think the cast is great. And I think really like about what they've done is they've built up a cast of characters.
The Madeleine Swann character is back, played by Lea Seydoux.
We'll say yes for now. Because if it's anything
Naomi
like
Naomi Harris is once again alongside us. The
again made Moneypenny. Made Moneypenny into a character rather than just a cipher.
And like you say, Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah,
will be back as Felix. It's still only rumored that Christopher Waltz is going to be Blofeld.
Nothing
has been confirmed. I would like him to return because I feel that it didn't really resolve the Blofeld kind of storyline. We got to see the creation of the Blofeld character scarred on the face by the end of that last film. But I don't feel it really gave him a chance to be a true menace.
I'm thinking yes.
And get, you know, if this is going to be Daniel Craig's last outing, then it would make sense for it to be a climax with him going up against Blofeld for the final time.
And he's one of those characters, again, that works within Bond, that has been recast numerous times, even within one actor's run on it. You know, there were numerous Blofelds. Telly Savalas stands out for that. Donald Pleasance,
definitely.
Fantastic. Yeah, I hope so. I'm looking forward to it. I'm a real sucker for this Bond series. Did I tell you I had a strange dream that Jeffrey Wright was playing Commissioner Gordon, and then we talked about it on the show, or did we?
I'm convinced I've had that dream as well. I'm sure that we at least name dropped him when we were talking about Joker News on the last.
Yeah, because we'll talk about Batman Jonah
News.
Hill.
We were talking about Jonah Hill, like what character he's going to be. And I'm sure that we name dropped.
If he can make Felix Leiter an interesting character, then and what he can do with Commish.
Yeah,
the Commish is. I'm really looking forward to it.
I mean, you know, I've got me Westworld Pops on the wall next to me, and I just can't help but notice like
so
character from Westworld sat up there like staring at me.
But, moving on.
You know, spinning off from the Bond news, we mentioned that the posters kind of emulated the Bourne. Well, the Bourne series is now getting expanded out via a TV series.
Yeah, which apparently they can't mention in the series Jason Bourne. And it's Treadway, isn't it?
Yeah.
Treadway was the organisation behind the Jason Bourne super soldier storylines. It was very Captain America when I watched it again. That would have been an interesting way for Cap to go. And funny enough, this has been a week of TV series. Not as much movie news as we used to have.
There's a lot of TV news, but it's that time of year when all the new shows are getting like concepts put around them. They're planning for the mid-season, like switchovers. Then they're planning for like the late summer, what's going to be new next year. So it's no surprise that Newsworth is dominated by it. But, you know, with regards to the Bourne one, I mean, the TV series is going to expand much like Legacy did on the whole concept of that world. Producer Ben Smith has also dropped some hints that there's another film, because he's hinted that the new show will have big connections to the new film. As he quotes himself, "I mean, we are definitely working on another film. What we're doing with that, will there be connected tissue in terms of are we all existing within the same world and universe? Absolutely. The details of that are still under wraps." So whilst he's confirmed there's a new film, he can't say what, who, when, why and how.
You see, again, it's the right time to walk away from that character for Matt Damon was at the end of the third one.
Yeah.
There was no need to bring him back for Jason Bourne. It was an okay movie. There's nothing wrong with it. It felt as though we didn't need it. We didn't find anything else new about the character that we didn't already know. It worked in those three films, and that's why it didn't have the big impact on the box office, because we'd explored that world and we'd explored Jason Bourne, and we needed to see. An interesting way to go would be kind of the old man Logan, the Logan style of Jason Bourne. And I still think that that's what, you know, Sean Connery could have done.
Yeah.
And come back and play Bond one last time as old man Bond. That would have been interesting. Instead of saying never say never again.
Old man Bond sounds like a Cockney knees up song.
It does. Oh, I've got a case of that.
Old man Bond.
I saw the postcard.
Chaz and Dave playing on the piano.
If you do want to contact us about any movie news, you can reach us on Twitter via
@FilmFileUK.
Keep coming in with information. As I said, lots and lots of TV trailers. Snowpiercer is out as a TV series on TNT, I think it is, in the States. I don't know whether we'll get it over here. But it looks great. Apparently, it's going back more to the original French graphic novel.
Yeah.
As well as tying in a similar sort of style to the great movie that came out a couple of years ago. We starred Chris Evans. But there's a trailer out there, which is this beautifully animated trailer, which sort of tells the story of how Snowpiercer and the world came to be. So that's pretty good. There's a new trailer out for Star Trek Picard.
Not had a chance to catch that new trailer yet. I'm just excited for the whole series.
Yeah, a lot of familiar faces coming back. Jonathan Frakes is returning as Riker. Interesting to see it.
Back
as, yeah, really interesting to see where it goes after this. He's one of those actors, isn't he? That he brought so much pathos and depth to Picard that I'm looking forward to seeing him work again. And the BBC trailer for War of the Worlds, have you seen that one?
I've not, no. I'm excited because I'm a big fan of H.G. Wells's writing, and I've enjoyed to some degree pretty much every interpretation of that on the big screen, including that rather weak TV series from like the 90s.
Ooh, yeah, I remember that.
Which basically tried to tell a continuation of the story in modern day, and it was cheesy, but I found myself compellingly watching it. I just love that whole mankind is being invaded by beings from Mars or whatever they decide to do, and mankind can't win. But you know, in a great H.G. Wells story, it's basically bacteria destroys them because they've never encountered the bacteria that we become immune to.
Fantastic.
Great storytelling.
Fantastic story.
But, in recent years, we had Spielberg's modern-day interpretation, which a lot of people are very dismissive of, but I think it was powerful.
Yeah, it just fell apart in the last 10 minutes, really.
Yeah, there's some moments in that film that are truly chilling and truly, like, horrific, and I think he captured the essence of
post-9/11, didn't he?
But, you know, I've been wanting to see a good adaptation set within, like, the era that the Wells story was.
Well, you'll be happy to know from the look of the trailer, it looks like a period piece.
Yeah, because and I remember when it was first announced, like they said, the BBC wanted to do like an authentic adaptation, like so we get to see like the point of view from the narrator of the story as like he slowly researches and slowly encounters elements and how that affects the world around him. So I've got to check out the trailer because I am excited about the concept of it. I want the BBC to do well. And the BBC are doing some solid like adaptations recently. I mean, on the horizon, we've got the His Dark Material series, which is being co-producing with HBO.
And they did Good Omens.
Yeah.
The Neil Gaiman project.
Again, like a co-production.
It was with Amazon, wasn't it? Directly with Amazon? Yeah.
Yeah. A great adaptation of, it meandered around some elements of the book and removed a few things.
Yeah, it just wasn't as funny as I wanted it to be.
But it captured the essence of like, I think it captured more the essence of Gaiman than Pratchett.
Yes. I'll totally agree with you. And I really thought everything about it. I liked the casting. I liked the style of it. I liked all the elements of it. I missed the humour that Terry Pratchett brought to it. And with Neil Gaiman writing the script, it felt as though it hung on too much to the book, but it lost that humour. And it's one of the only books I've ever read where I was sat on a tube in London. I was reading it. I was laughing out loud, funny. Which will bring us round to Joker in a little while.
But so nice to see the BBC starting to like move away from like standard period dramas and things like that and finally getting back to doing what BBC used to do all those decades ago by introducing us to fantasy concepts, science fiction concepts, far out there kind of concepts. Great. Can't wait.
Yeah, we're kind of missing, aren't we, at the moment? I mean, we've got Doctor Who coming back, but we're kind of missing the BBC used to do great horror. People forget, you know, the Nigel Neal stuff that they did, you know, the Quatermass series and, you know, stone tapes and things like that. The BBC did great horror, and I think there's a lacking a great British horror show that could be a period piece, could be, you know, but just something. And we've got a, you know, we get these Mark Gatiss produced things usually coming up at Christmas. I'm a great Christmas ghost story. It's part of the my family tradition of having Christmas ghost stories. But I do miss the good BBC horrors. I think there's room for that.
A quick light and throwback to a bit of news that we've done before, which was, you know, the current resurgence of Eddie Murphy with him doing Coming to America.
Yeah.
There's now been further news on his future of his career, which seems to be a throwback to the past of his career, because he's now been announcing Beverly Hills Cop 4.
Really?
Yeah. It's apparently it's been in development on and off for over the past decade. Brett Ratner was attached at one point. It was then like...
He's not going to be making any films for some time, is he, Brett Ratner, now?
Then it was looked to be like a TV series following the son of Axel Foley. But now it's been retooled into a film again with new writers and a new setup. And Murphy, who's been, you know, doing Dolomite Is My Name, which is coming to Netflix. And also...
Have you seen the trailer for that?
America. Again, I'm used to the trailers.
It looks absolutely... It looks really funny. Apparently, it's a true story about a guy who creates a character and starts to create a movie around it in the time of the black exploitation movies, you know, the Superflies and your Shafts. It looks very funny. I really want to see Eddie Murphy come back. I want to see him come back and come back with something powerful to prove that Eddie Murphy was once at one time. And kids, you know, younger listeners, you're not going to believe that, because you'll have probably seen him in some really atrocious family.
He was
family.
The name.
He was the funniest guy on the planet at one point.
Well, yeah. In his own words, Beverly Hills Cop 4 is what we're doing after Coming to America. We're doing Beverly Hills Cop, and then the plan is to get back on stage and do stand-up. That's fantastic. What I'll be doing mostly is stand-up. These movies and Saturday Night Live, it's kind of like I'm looking at it as a bookend. If I decided I wanted to stay on the couch forever and ended it on a funny note. So he's getting back to his roots. And I'm excited about seeing him go back to stand-up, because he was biting in stand-up.
He was incredible. And you forget how young he was when he started on... You know, you look back at Eddie Murphy Live and Raw, he was just a very, very young man, barely, you know, into his 20s. And he had that sudden rise to fame, a ridiculous rise to fame, hit after hit after hit. And we've all got one great Eddie Murphy movie. I mean, the first Beverly Hills Cop was fantastic, you know, that anarchy of that character, Coming to America, Trading Places, there was hit after hit. And then he started down the family film, and that sort of put his career into a bit of a tailspin. They were still big hits, but the biting, clever Eddie Murphy that we'd seen in the past 48 hours, when you see him in 48 hours, he rules the screen and as a secondary character, and he just proved they had that star potential. I really like to see Eddie Murphy do something that is funny, that isn't a... I mean, I hope it's Beverly Hills Cop 4. I'm not holding my breath on it. Beverly Hills Cop 3, directed by John Landis, who I really like, was a bit weak. Do you remember it? Have you seen Beverly Hills Cop 3?
Yes, the theme park.
Yeah. Do you remember the cameo?
No.
George Lucas.
Oh.
George Lucas cameoed in Beverly Hills Cop 3. The beard himself. Welcome back, Eddie Murphy. You have fantastic screen presence, and it'd be nice to see you do something edgy. It'd be nice to see you do something like a 48 hours. Don't do a 48 hours 3, but something like a 48 hours where you can be foul-mouthed and funny and have that big screen presence again. So welcome back, Eddie Murphy. We approve.
Flashing back to, we've done news in the past about Kevin Smith with his Jane Silent Bob's reboot, which is on our doorstep. It's not far away now. But it's been confirmed over the past week or so that Clerks 3 is back on.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Kevin Smith. I was one of the people at the time who just thought he'd hit that. He had a great voice. And when Clerks came out, I went to see it. And it was the art cinema here in our hometown. And it was packed. It was rammed. Loved Chasing Amy. I think Chasing Amy is a perfect film. It's the Kevin Smith film that I always go back to. It's funny. It's got that humour that runs through all his film, and it had pathos, and it said something. And I like Dogma, but after Dogma, it sort of went astray.
I've got a lot of love for Jalen Silent Bob Strikes Back. I love the his whole mocking of his own films throughout it. It's a very fourth wall breaking film. And I had fun watching it. And I rewatched that only about 6 months ago. And I still have fun. Like, right. The little elements. But that was basically a fan servicing film.
Yes.
To be the fact it was intended to be the last one of that whole like askew universe ones before he moved on to other things like Jersey Girl,
which Red State.
I've got some love for Jersey Girl because I could kind of relate to the like the parental relationship going on in there and like all the family issues, and so I took to it quite well. Red State, solid film. I think.
Yeah, it went astray for me.
I found like the performances like powerful. I would have loved to have seen his original intention for the ending.
Yes,
where it was actually going to be the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Yeah,
right, the
voice of God, wasn't it? That yeah, that they hear.
But I think that that little nugget of twist at the end, like with the like the bells start chiming, you think, oh my God, it's all happening. It's just that something else is going on. And I love the character drama within there. There's the guy in it who plays the preacher, Michael Parks.
Michael Parks, yeah.
Who he has like 5 minutes monologues in it that I was just captivated with, because I think that was benefited a lot by his presence on screen in anything. Is always quite captivating. He was always.
He passed away recently, didn't he, Michael Parks? Who I think on.
I believe so. Yeah. Mm.
Melissa Leo was in it. She's a great screen presence. There's a lot I liked about Red State. I thought the setup was great. It was horrific. It didn't stay true to itself for me. And interesting, no character made it out alive, did they? Which I think in a horror movie, of course not everybody's got to get to the end, but I think you've got to have somebody you hold on to and root for. And when all the major characters were dying, I didn't know who was holding on to. But it was a very grown-up Kevin Smith film, and it didn't resemble Kevin Smith. I never saw Tusk. I never saw
Cop Out
with
Bruce
Willis.
Oh, you were so lucky.
Yeah, and you know, it was a studio film. But I do like Kevin Smith. I've got a lot of time for him. I'm looking forward to the reboot.
But the thing that's held back Clerks 3 from being made is he never wanted to make it unless he could get everyone back. And it was Jeff Anderson, who plays Randall,
right,
who's been holding out. He was like, there's no reason for this. There's no progression of the story. Well, it was at a convention that they were on a Q&A panel. So they'd met up properly for the first time in ages, and they just got on like house on fire again. And as soon as he went, the idea that I've got for the Clerks 3 with your character is this, and he's just gone, I'm in.
Okay.
And that's what's got it back on.
And at least to apologise for Clerks 2. Silly though, didn't
he? Yeah, it got a bit daft towards the...
Clerks wasn't about being daft. It was a character study, and that's what I liked about it.
The bits of Clerks 2 that I really enjoy is where it's inside...
Yeah, the first half.
Inside the restaurant, and then those two characters, Dante and Randall, just talking smack about it, like about things. The whole criticism of the Lord of the Rings film scene.
Yeah. Oh, I was with it until that the silly sequences towards the end, and then it lost me. But I'm a big Kevin Smith fan. I love his comic work as well. His early run on Daredevil was fantastic. I like the widening gear he did with Batman. I'd like to see that get finished. I like him as a writer. I think he says something. He's doing a lot of TV now. He's doing The Flash, doing Supergirl.
Welcome it. Now, I wonder if Martin Scorsese would consider Kevin Smith films as cinema.
Interesting, with Martin Scorsese's comments over the last week, which have had, of course, fanboys taking to Twitter, getting out of the mother's basement, and then straight back.
It's blowing out of proportion completely. I mean, what he actually said is, when asked about like Marvel films and superhero films, he said, I don't see them. I tried, you know, but that's not cinema. Honestly, the closest I can think of them, as well made as they are, with actors doing the best they can under the circumstances, is theme parks. It isn't the cinema of human beings trying to convey emotional, psychological experiences to another human being. And I can completely get that.
You said something interesting, which I hope you remember what you said.
If you had added two words onto one section of that, that wouldn't have been an issue, because everyone's hung up on that's not cinema. If you had just added to me.
Yeah.
But what you have to realise, he was talking in open conversation in an interview setting. I'm pretty sure that when you're talking with your friends or anyone about anything, you occasionally like don't fill in words because you assume that the audience understands what you mean. It's not cinema to him. That's what he's saying. He's not saying it's not cinema. It's all rubbish and it should be destroyed. He just doesn't take to that type of cinema.
Yeah. Everyone is allowed an opinion.
Yeah. For me, Adam Sandler's not cinema, but the audiences who go to watch his films tell me otherwise.
Or did.
Now they'll just watch it on Netflix.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because I'm actually excited about Adam Sandler's next film, which is The Uncut Gems.
Okay.
Getting really good reviews.
Is it?
Yeah.
The things you don't normally hear in a sentence.
It's another one of those like, oh, he can act kind of films. But anyway, you know, with Scorsese, I think all the fanboys just need to, you know, just grow
calm
up.
Calm down. We're all allowed an opinion.
I'm a huge fanboy myself. We are movie geeks. Yeah. We are film geeks and we are comic book geeks. And we can understand getting passionate about something, but Scorsese wasn't disparaging everything about the films that you enjoy. He was saying they're not his cup of tea.
Yeah.
That's what that whole sentence sums up to. He even says, like, you know, they are well made. The actors are doing the best that they can. You know, he's not saying, like, oh, James Gunn, your films are rubbish. He's saying, no, they are well made. He's not criticising the way that they present on the screen. He's just saying, I'm not going to go out my way to watch them.
The bigger issue is that fandoms become this, that it's very precious. You're not allowed to think outside of what's regulated. You know, Ethan Hawke, I remember, didn't like Logan.
Yeah.
You know, and fanboys turned on him. You're not allowed, you don't have to like everything. I'm not a big fan. People are going to be, pitchforks are going to be coming down outside my house probably now. Christopher Nolan's Batman take.
No.
I'm not a huge fan of it. It's just me. It wasn't my idea of what Batman should be. I've talked about it on this program. You can't like everything. You don't have to like everything. I'm sorry. It's just the way of the world. But it doesn't stop you liking it, and it doesn't take it away. And those movies are out there for us to enjoy. It doesn't mean you have to go and burn down effigies of Martin Scorsese at one time. And it sounds with the reviews for The Irishman, he may be back. The greatest filmmaker on the planet. So, you know, just calm it down. It's his opinion. It doesn't stop you liking it. And it doesn't mean that they are bad films. I kind of agree with James Gunn. You know, I've not got into Martin Scorsese's later work recently. It's been a letdown. The Silence did absolutely nothing for me. I don't agree with what he's saying, but he's entitled to that opinion, yeah, as you are entitled to yours. He's entitled to his, as I'm entitled to mine.
Let's just round up the news this week. I mean, we said that it's all TV news this week, but we've clearly just been talking for about 30 yes, minutes about film news. But I would just want to touch on Bruce Campbell dropping the big bombshell that there's another Evil Dead film. With a new director, which is going to be picking up on the 2013...
Oh, really? I didn't realise that.
By Fede Alvarez, because he's also kind of confirmed that that is an official sequel.
Yes.
Evil Dead films. It's just a new group of people finding that cabin, because even Sam Raimi's car is still within that film.
Yeah.
So it's seen as that's connected to it. It's an official sequel. Yes, it was more guttural and visceral, whereas like the Evil Dead franchise went more like slapstick comedy.
Yeah, they went very broad.
But if you look back at the very first Evil Dead film, it wasn't slapstick comedy.
No, it was...
And that's what Alvarez's film was going back to, but yeah, Making it in a more bloody, like, kind of modern setting. So we're going to see a continuation of that story, which, if it's set within that same universe, is officially a continuation of the Ash versus Evil Dead story at the same time.
Well, it did drop Bruce Campbell at the end of it. I thought it was okay. I didn't see it as a remake. The characters weren't called anything the same. The storyline was different. It was about the cabin more than it was about being a reboot. It felt like a reboot sequel. And then with Campbell making that appearance, it solidified that to me, that it was that. I like the Evil Dead series, but yeah, people have to remember when it came out, it was seen as being very, very, yeah, very visceral.
In the UK, it was a video nasty that was, yeah, banned.
And there's a story for another podcast, the whole banning of films. You're listening to The Film File with Lee and Andy, and you can reach us again. Are we going to start doing this? Because we got to the end of last show and I thought we didn't do enough hashtags how to reach us. So you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, or any other good podcast supplier. So the big film out this week, and we have to talk about it. Are we going to try and not be spoilery?
I think that in order to properly talk about it, at some point we need to do spoilers. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about it generally as a film, and then we'll have like some kind of klaxon or maybe a maniacal laugh as a spoiler.
Maniacal laugh seems to fit
towards the end of this
well.
Episode where we'll touch in it. So we'll basically close off the episode, but then keep it open for people who want to hear our thoughts on aspects of the film, which, unfortunately, because of the kind of film that it is, have to delve into spoiler territory.
You know, I do stand-up comedy. You should come see a show sometime.
I could do that.
People think you're weird. They don't feel comfortable around you.
I don't want you worrying about money, Mom. Or me.
All that sacrifice, she must love you very much.
She always tells me to smile and put on a happy face.
You're so funny, aren't they?
So, I've just seen it. You saw it a couple of days ago. You've had more time to process it. It's the film at the moment that everyone's talking about. for not exactly the reasons that we thought everyone would be talking about. And it's something I didn't see, which is this sort of zeitgeist of kind of what's been happening in the US with white guys in particular feeling as though the world owes them something, going out and buying guns and wreaking havoc with loss of life and a sense that society has let them down and they are angry young men. I remember the same arguments happening with Fight Club.
Yeah.
And at no point do I think that, apart from a few underground fighting clubs, that anarchy ruled the streets. And I don't think anarchy will rule the streets after this. So, Andy, talk us through the plot.
So, it's an origin story. We're focusing purely on the Joker. And, you know, the Joker's been prevalent since the 50s when he was first introduced in Batman issue 1. And it originally intended just a one-off character, but became so popular. But he's been redefined for every era. In this one, we've got a guy named Arthur Fleck, who seems to be a bit downtrodden. He's got a mental disorder, which has...
Makes him laugh maniacally.
Makes him laugh in uncomfortable, nervous situations, which some people think is a bit weird. And so he gets taunted, he gets picked on, he gets abused. No one trusts him. He seems unliked by people. And it follows as, like, you know, he gets, like, beaten up. He gets, like, victimized on subway trains until he snaps. And then he snaps and he starts to realize that he enjoys the snap and he builds through. That's the surface level of the film.
Yeah, just to point out that he's a clown, isn't he, at the beginning? And yeah. He's got aspirations of being a stand-up comedian, which feels like those elements were taken out of Alan Moore's Killing Joke.
Yeah.
To choose our words very carefully.
Well, let's talk about casting. I mean, you know...
Okay, so Joaquin Phoenix plays Joker, and it is a phenomenal...
His commitment to it, and the weight loss that he's gone through for the role, the contortions that he does whenever he's like...
These beautifully shot, very stylized, very slow motion sort of dance sequences that he performs, which are sort of cross between dancing and Tai Chi, I thought, which is purely physical performance. It's a beautiful performance because you're watching a character that is actually quite unlikable. And when you do find yourself, and you don't sympathize with him, at no point during the film I sympathized with the character. I empathized, which is a different ball game entirely. There are moments when you empathize with him. He's the complete anti-hero. And a lot of people have thrown their hankies in the air on this one because he's a character who brings chaos. That's what the Joker does. He brings murder. That's what the Joker does. And let's not forget, this is a movie that is, and its heart of it, if you're staying true to what the Joker is a supervillain. Even though it's told in a realistic setting, it's sold in a sort of world of the 70s. What I did like from the get-go was the old Warner's logo at the beginning of the screen.
That bright red background with the black W.
Which reminded me of
interestingly as well, every other film based on a comic book property is then followed by like the logo representative of the company.
Yeah.
The DC, logo doesn't appear until the very end of the end credits.
Right.
They've made it clear that this is not a connected tissue to the DCEU.
It doesn't fit into any of the current DC continuity. It's a film on its own. And this is where it's very bold. It tells a story about a character that isn't related to the DC universe. And we've spoken about this on the show. That was DC's biggest mistake was trying to
force everything together.
Yeah, to force it into a universe the way that Marvel did it and tried to go down the steps that Marvel did it. Instead of Warner's taking control and saying, this is a film that we've created. It should stand alone. It's a Superman film. It's a Batman film. And clearly the audience didn't want that connected tissue that they got from Marvel. And it stands out on its own. It looks amazing. It's shot in this very 70s way. 70s filmmaking is my favorite period. So, and it captures that perfectly. It has that feel of Scorsese's Mean Streets. It's very Scorsese-esque a lot of the way through from that particular period. Taxi Driver springs instantly to mind. King of Comedy springs instantly to mind. It's the films that they used to make, funny enough, where the anti-hero, like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, were the lead characters. The same sort of condemnation for it from much more superior critiques than ourselves. Failed to draw on. This was a time where there was cinema was like this. It did present interesting characters who you didn't necessarily like. Half a dozen spring to mind from that particular period. That's what I loved about it. That's what I really liked.
It's a very mature direction from Todd Phillips, and it's a far cry from his frat boy humour of the past. Definitely benefited by his continuing work with Lawrence Sher, the cinematographer,
yeah.
who, like, looks amazing. As bad as the Hangover films got by the third one, they still look beautiful.
In fact, that was my problem with the Hangover films, that they were drama looking instead of comedy looking.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
I think the first one was a lot like more comedy feel throughout it. But yeah, the second and third ones, I mean, by the third one, I hardly laughed watching it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because the jokes weren't funny. It's because the jokes weren't there.
Yeah.
It was a very dark, twisted way to finish the trilogy.
Yeah, and it looked like great cinematic films.
I mean, with Love and Share, I mean, I only realised when, like, looking up, like, his previous work, he was just the cinematographer on one of my favourite films of the past few decades, Garden State.
Oh, I love Garden State.
What an amazing film. I mean, every bit of imagery, him stood with the shirt against the wall, is just a great shot because he's off to the side. And that is evidence of, like, how skillful Love and Share is of getting, like, a beautiful-looking shot. And in Joker, I think it's a masterpiece of cinematography.
It is an amazing looking film. I like the time period for it, this sort of end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and it definitely is a time period. You look at the cars, they go to the cinema, and I noticed a cinema poster for the film Wolfen was up there, so it instantly gives it a time period. So that's what I really liked about it. The performances are great. Robert De Niro's in it. He's playing almost Rupert Pumpkin again from King of Comedy, has now got his own talk show. I think trying to tie it into DC, into the DC folklore, was the thing that let it down for me. There's a portrayal of Thomas Wayne, who Batman fans will know as Bruce Wayne's father. There's a storyline with a very young Bruce Wayne in it. I am starting to edge into spoiler territory.
But we'll come back to that at the end of the episode.
And those were the things that I felt more uncomfortable. I was more interested when it was a standalone film than having to tie into, yes, it's set in Gotham. Yes, it does tie a little bit into the DC universe. Those were the more bigger letdowns for me. Didn't like the portrayal of Thomas Wayne. I didn't think that's what I believe Thomas Wayne to be. And if it has, it did encroach into those properties. I didn't need that to make it interesting. As an overall film, it's a very visceral film. I don't think it's going to incite riots, certainly not in this country. So I don't think that disenfranchised feel.
I think that the old controversies that it's going to glamorise violence, it doesn't glamorise violence.
No,
when the
it
violence
doesn't.
Comes, it's brutal, it's shocking, and it jolts you.
Yeah,
it doesn't make you go, wow, that was cool. Yeah. It makes you go, oh, wow.
Though there's a scene on the subway train which leads to violence that, interestingly enough, I was caught up in the character to want him to fight back.
Yeah.
And that surprised me. It's a very adult film. It's not a Batman movie in the way that one would expect a Batman movie, and especially in light of where Marvel have taken their characters and recently DC have taken their characters. And for that, it needs to be applauded. It's a very, very interesting take on a character. And we've been talking about this for ages. How can you make a Joker movie without mentioning Batman? Well, you can.
Yeah.
Quite simply. And it's all there on the screen. With fantastic performance, with a very, very gritty film. It does stray occasionally into pretentious, but I'm okay with that because I'd rather they be bold than to be fearful of stepping into territory, which so far no comic book, mainstream comic book movie has stepped into.
With the controversies, I mean, there's been reports of, like, cinemas in the US that have had police presence outside.
FBI giving a warning about it.
AMC cinemas, there have been a few of them reported that they had signs up saying no one's to be allowed admittance on their own. Everyone has to come with other people.
Really?
Because they're that afraid of, like, lone idiots. That's not representative to me of the power of this film itself. That's representative of the society that we live in
at
the moment.
That's a really good point. I think you've answered that perfectly.
And whereas, like, people often say that art imitates life, well, and life imitates art, this is a true case of the art imitating life. Is that what the Joker film is representing is the environment that we're living in at the moment. And anything that you're worried about that film containing, it's actually happening on your streets at the moment, and you should be more worried about that than what a work of fiction can do.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that, like, about the Joker as a character, there's no definitive Joker. Everyone is representative of the times that you live in. You see people say, like, Heath Ledger, the definitive Joker. Well, he was for that moment in time.
Yeah.
I think Joaquin Phoenix is the definitive Joker for the moment in time because he's reflecting the troubles of our society. It's a hard film to discuss in detail without dropping into spoiler territory. It's a film that sits with you after you watch it. You don't just finish watching it and go, "Way, let's go and get a burger." You sit in your journey home in complete silence as you're processing elements of the film.
Yeah, you will discuss this.
It's powerful. It's stunning. There's ways that you can interpret moments in the film in different ways. And it's a film that provokes discussion. To me, that should overwrite any controversies, simply because anything that provokes discussion can only be a good thing.
And this has been said before. This was said with Taxi Driver, that it would incite violence and vigilantism. It was said with Falling Down, which I think this film is very, very close to in its essence. They said it with Fight Club, which we mentioned earlier. They say it with lots and lots of films. I don't believe there's that correlation. If somebody is going to, you know, there was that guy who opened fire in a screening of Dark Knight Rises, dressed as a Joker-type character. Now, if some nut job is going to go out, and let's be honest, if you're thinking of harming other people, you're a nut job. I'm sorry, I don't know if there's a more PC term for it. If you're going to go out and harm people and you think you're influenced by a movie, then it's a very, very shorthand way to write off mental illness or problems within a society. I don't think we'll get anything like this in the UK. I hope I'm wrong, but and I'm pretty sure that I'm wrong. I don't think we have that correlation. You can... President Trump recently made correlation between video games and violence. It's much more of a society problem. People can find triggers in all sorts of things. If they're going to find a trigger out of this movie, it's too grown up a movie for mass consumption. I saw it in a packed theater, but it's a grown up movie, and you can tell when people are coming to see one thing and it's not, and you start to feel start to hear shuffling a little bit, because this is not a comic book movie. But it's inspired by a comic book story. And the thing about the Joker is there is not one defined origin story for that character.
Every time that he's reinterpreted, it's a different origin. And you never know what the true origin of the Joker ever was.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it just represents whatever age we live in. And they keep redefining him. In the comics, they just keep mashing the universes together in like various crises and flashpoints and things like that in order to correct any continuity issues. I don't want to know a definitive origin.
No,
I
love
having
be.
Interpretations. And again, there'll be more on that in the spoilers.
Okay, shall we get into spoiler territory? Well, sound the alarm. Okay, we're in spoiler territory. If you want to keep listening, please do. If you're interested to hear what we talk about, then we are going to mention some key plots and a little bit of a spoilery spoiler givers, we're not going to blow the movie for you.
So the big key element for the film for me is at about three quarters of the way through the film, there's a revelation that a relationship that he's been in with his neighbour, who he bumped into a few times, then she came to the door and said, "You've been stalking me," and they arranged a date. They went on a date and it's a happy romance and he's got some happiness in his life. He imagined the whole thing. At that point, I realised that the whole film is the Joker's narrative to justify all of his actions.
Right.
Which makes you go back to the early moments when you were sympathising with him because he was getting like a billboard stolen off him. He chases the kids who got it and then they beat him up. Was that billboard stolen? Because his boss was told by the shop owner that he just walked off with the billboard. So maybe he did a Fight Club on himself and he's creates this false reality around him. There's the key moments, like, which is the start of the killings on the subway, that starts all this violence and like uprising against the rich. We're led to believe by the way it's shot and the way it's shown that it was a reaction to being beaten up by three rich guys who were drunk and like picking on him because he was dressed as a clown. Now that we have this whole thing of like, you have to question everything, maybe that didn't happen that way round and he actually confronted them and just murdered someone on the subway. Every element of the film needs to be re-scrutinized. And at that point, he's no longer, I mean, you mentioned anti-hero. He can be seen as an anti-hero. On the surface level, you can see it as an anti-hero uprising. But when you start to go, oh, wow, we have to doubt everything that he's told us to this point. He's no longer an anti-hero. He's the criminal psychotic of Joker that has always been a criminal psychotic in every representation.
Absolutely.
There's a reason he always gets locked in Arkham Asylum. He's criminally psychotic. He's mentally unstable. He's deranged and he thinks that he's doing good things. He's clearly not. There's people who are like saying like, you know, I can relate to him. If you can relate to this character, I really am concerned about you and you need to go and seek help because he kills people indiscriminately. You don't see some deaths, but they're suggested. There's some assaults that are suggested. He's not a nice character by the time at the end of the film comes, when you look back on how he's actually acted and put it into a different context. There's suggestions towards the end of the film that he's just stopped taking his medication. However, any moments that we see with him playing with his medication early in the film, you never see him take the medication. You just see him playing with empty bottles and two pills. How many years has he just been playing with two pills? He's been off the deep end since before the film began. And that's how I've started to perceive it. I can't wait to go back and rewatch the film from that context and start to see the different ideas that you can get from it. You know, I might be completely wrong, but I picked this up as soon as I'd watched it, and that was what I was processing in the taxi home after watching it. And then the next day went online and found other people theorising the same thing. And it seemed that whole scene with him, the relationship being false, has to have been put there for that very reason, to get you to suddenly go, this narrative is skewed.
The elements I did like is the Joker is an agent of chaos, and that came out of it. And I almost wanted to see that expanded. I'd been more interested in seeing building up the movement that follows him or follows the Joker. But it is about disenfranchised people finding a way out. Now, the Joker, for me, wasn't the Clown Prince of crime, which he should be for a Joker. But this is the point of the movie. It's an interpretation. You know, these aren't gospels. They are an artist's interpretation of that character, and that was what was bold about it. The film does have faults, and for the faults it does have, you cannot get away from the fact that they have tried to do something absolutely unique with this character, and therefore unique with comic book movies. At the heart of it, it is a comic book movie. It's a character that we've grown up with. He's the most recognisable villain. A supervillain out of the whole of comics. He's the one. He's had so many different interpretations. The look of him, the fact that he is chaos, is the antithesis of who Batman is. He is the most recognizable supervillain. You can put any villain in front of my mom, and she will pick out the Joker. So I think it's a very, very bold film. Doesn't always work for me. There's the elements that I have to think about. As I said, I've only just walked out of a screen.
Yeah, you've got time to settle me.
So a lot of what I'm talking about is I'm free-forming here, folks. But it's definitely a strong film. I think there are Oscar nominations that should be in the pipeline for Joaquin Phoenix's performance, and I think for Todd Phillips. Interested to know what other people think about it. Get in touch with us via our Twitter page or email us. It's an interesting, very, very bold film. And I don't think, as far as I'm aware, there has been a mainstream comic book property which has been dealt with in such a way.
I know one of the problems that you had was regards the representation of Thomas Wayne.
Yeah.
Who's portrayed within this film as being a bit of a dick, a rich dick who looks down on the people below him. There's like a little like news clipping of him like talking about like the lower classes as clowns. However, again, drawing reference to that this is Arthur's skewed perspective, maybe that wasn't actually what was said.
There's
a bit at the start of the film
where it becomes a fantasy where he steps into.
He's in the audience of a game show and it plays out. So maybe every time that he sees something, he imagines something different.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the comic book history, the film history, everything history-wise that we've ever seen about Thomas Wayne is that he was a really good benefactor towards, like, the homeless, the disenfranchised. He put money into the community to rebuild elements of Gotham. He was always looking towards, like, people like with less wealth than him and going, I've got more wealth than I need. I'm going to invest in you guys. I want you. He'd hire people from like poor, impoverished societies and try to give them a better way of life. And that's the Thomas Wayne that we've always been told. So to suddenly see him in this jarring context, I mean, it initially jarred me. And I was like, I don't like this.
No, I didn't.
This is stepping on the toes of like what's been established. But like I say, it was when that revelation came and I started to question what I'd seen up to that point. I was like, right. So basically, Arthur and his mother have been harassing this guy for years, and we don't know to what extent they've been doing it. We just know they're banned from communication with the Wayne family because his mother had some fantasy obsession that she had bore his child. There's so much to then go back and reanalyze, and that's why that second watch needs to be done.
Yeah, I totally agree. I will see it again.
I think, you know, like I said, it's a film that makes you question things. It's a film that makes you think, and a film that provokes discussion. And everyone will have their own interpretation of it. I never want them to do a sequel.
No, I hope they don't. There's no room for a sequel.
Joaquin Phoenix has said that, like, him and Todd Phillips have talked about, like, you know, working together and possibly, like, delving into the Joker again. Don't. That Joker title is a standalone. We don't want it running the risk of being diminished by explaining too much. It's a film that leaves questions. It's a film that gets your brain chewing it over. If they in the next film go, well, actually, this is what happened. Oh, well, you've just blown the film.
Yeah, you've got to. I can't see where they can take the character on the basis of what we've seen. I never say never, but from what I've seen so far, I can't see without getting into the other territory of because there is a set off point for Bruce Wayne's story, which was a surprise and again slightly unwelcome for me. I'd rather it seem be more self contained. The fact that it was set in Gotham was just enough. Arkham Asylum's mentioned. But at some point, you have to, if you're going to carry on with this character as the way it's perceived in this film, you know, you will tiptoe into other elements of the Batman legend. And I'd rather not. I'd rather see it stand alone.
I've seen random theories thrown out that, you know, because Bruce Wayne's quite young in this, that, you know, if this is the Joker that he goes against, then this Joker's going to be like in his late 70s by the time he's fighting Batman.
Yeah.
But I've seen people suggest that, well, this is a character that inspires the Joker, the Batman.
Yeah, I could see that.
And I've also seen a theory that the only real element of this film is the very last scene in Arkham when he's talking to the psychiatrist, and the rest of it is all his fictional account of how he got into asylum.
I could see that as well.
And, this is, again, why I want to rewatch it, because I want to see whether that actually stands up to scrutiny, because that would give an interesting take, because that would make sense with the Joker, is that, like, well, I'm locked in here for false reasons.
I'm going to leave it there, folks. What we do at the end of every programme, I ask Andy what neat thing he's seen, done, played with. I'll rephrase that. Played over the last couple of weeks. Anything?
Last night went to a smashing gig by a band who've been around for just around a year. Sheffield-based band. They've been gigging solidly across Europe and the UK pretty much consistently. They've made a lot of festival things. I was first aware of them last Christmas when I went to the Joe Carnell Jr. Christmas Knees Up gig, which is always a great night out. Sophie and the Giants. When I first saw them, me and my mate, as soon as they're halfway through their first track, we were just like, these are amazing. So I went home and like checked out the small three or four tracks that they'd already released by that point. I was like, yeah, I really like them. And I've been like really like pushing and promoting them, putting their music into the playlists at work quite frequently, getting people like, oh, what's this? What's this? So bringing more and more. I saw them earlier this year in a small, very like cozy gig at like above like a music shop, which had about 20 or 30 people in it. Last night at Leadmill, they had a substantial crowd.
Great. I love it when a band comes.
They are really starting to like build that momentum. If you've never found, like, check them out, just go onto Twitter and just find their account. Just search for Sophie and the Giants. Go onto your Spotify's, your Google Play, whatever you use, search for them. Check out their music. My brother-in-law, like, when he first checked out the music, he went, oh, well, it's okay, but I don't quite get it. When he saw them live last night, he gets it. The lead singer, Sophie, she's got an amazing voice, such a vocal range and so powerful. And you can see, watching them live, this is a band who enjoy what they're doing. They are really into it. They love it. I also discovered last night, because I bought some more merchandise from them, the T-shirt that I bought last time that I was wearing last night, they only made about 20 odd of them. So I've actually got a rare T-shirt, because I had a few people like in the audience like, where'd you get that T-shirt from? Oh, long-term fan, been with them for a while. It's like, oh, do they do them anymore? Don't think so. So cool.
Sophie and the Giants.
Sophie and the Giants. Get them checked out.
You heard it here first.
They're going to be the next big thing. I think we're going to be hearing a lot about them over the next year.
Fantastic. I'm going to mention a trailer that I've seen for El Camino, which is coming to Netflix in the next couple of weeks, I think. And it's a Breaking Bad movie, and it follows what happened to Jesse Pinkman after the end of the last episode of Breaking Bad. From the trailer, I got nothing from it, which is exactly what a good trailer should be. It made me excited. Jesse Pinkman was the interesting arc. Well, they were all interesting arcs in Breaking Bad, but I'd like to see where he's ended up. Is it a revenge thriller? I don't know. It's just one of those, but I'm so... so happy to be back in the world of Breaking Bad. I love Better Call Saul. I think what they've done was a really bold left of center move on exploring that character. And the writing is as up there with elements of Breaking Bad. I'm looking forward to the return of Jesse Pinkman. So that's El Camino. The trailer's out. It's coming soon to Netflix.
I'm really excited for that. I mean, before Better Call Saul came out, there was the whole like, oh, do we really need
a spin-off?
But that's showing that they'll only do it if there's a really good reason, a good story to tell. So I've got no doubt that this is going to be a good continuation of the story, because they wouldn't have just rushed into doing it for no reason at all.
Not
great
at all.
Shout.
Excellent. Okay, so this has been The Film File. I'm Lee Ford.
I'm Andy Meakin.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks. You can find us on Twitter at
FilmFileUK.
Get in touch with us. Let us know your thoughts. Subscribe. Tell your friends to subscribe. Tell anybody you meet in the street, and laugh maniacally when you do it.